When you have a loved one with dementia, the practical and emotional demands can be overwhelming. What if you could be grounded and confident, embracing the journey, even when a loved one has dementia? This is Catherine Hammond, and together with my co-host Kent Matthews, let's explore how to do that here on A Thriving Life. This podcast is sponsored by A Thriving Life, a membership community supporting people with a loved one with dementia. Find us online at athrivinglife.org. Hello, friends. Today we have the pleasure of chatting with Jane Barton. Jane is a passionate national speaker, author, and listener. She's the author of Caregiving for the Genius, and her entire professional life is focused on helping people deal with the daunting challenges of aging, serious illness, and end of life. She has a background in hospice and palliative care and currently serves as the AARP Caregiving Ambassador for Colorado. Take me back, Jane, to the beginning of your story with caregiving. When did you first hear about or experience caregiving in your life?
Well, I started as a caregiver at a relatively young age. I was called to care for my mom when I was 15 years of age. My mom was diagnosed with terminal breast cancer, and certainly that affected my entire family system. But as the daughter, I immediately assumed the majority of the responsibilities of her care, the hands-on care. And as a 15-year-old girl, you know, I didn't have a lot of life experience. I didn't have a lot of information. And back in the 70s, you just didn't talk about cancer like you do today. So we lacked a lot of support and a lot of information.
And so as a 15-year-old girl, you were, instead of being mothered, you took on the role of caregiver in your family.
I did. I had an abbreviated adolescence like a lot of children do. Millions of children are caring for their aging parents or grandparents. And so I can resonate and empathize with that experience. And it's not to say I wouldn't do it over again, because in all honesty, I wouldn't have done anything else because I absolutely adored my mom. But I was assuming a large responsibility of care, not just for my mom, but I assumed the responsibility of caring for our home, for cooking for my brother and my dad. I was still going to school. And as we continued that journey for 8.5 years, I also juggled going to college, holding down a job, and then also continuing to care. So many of the issues that caregivers today experience, I'm sure folks that are listening to the podcast today are nodding their head going, yes, I know that journey.
Right. Everyone who is thrust into the role of caregiver, none of us goes there willingly, has a lot of those same experiences. Were those things, taking all of that on and being the carer, did that come naturally to you or did it feel unnatural?
Well, I would describe myself as by nature, nurture, and necessity a caregiver. And I learned how to care by watching my mom when I was growing up. She was the quintessential caregiver, not only for our family, but for our whole neighborhood. She just had that essence and that spirit about her. And so when called to care for my mom, it really came as naturally as breathing. That doesn't mean it was easy, but it was my tendency just to merely embrace that role, to serve in that capacity, and to do the best I could.
And so what was it that brought you from caregiver by necessity to caregiving and caring for caregivers as a profession?
Well, it's been a rather interesting journey, to be quite honest, and as I reveal oftentimes in the programs that I present, I have a checkered past professionally, and I own up to that. My first profession was that of a petroleum geologist, and I worked in the oil patch for about 16 years. And I ran rigs all over the western U.S., and I managed teams of scientists, and I just had a big time. But I recognized that wasn't my calling. That was a job. It was a career. And so I made the decision to change professions. I went into finance. I did that for about 3 or 4 years, and again, it wasn't my calling. And so I made the decision to resign from my position, and I went to seminary. And I went there trying to figure out what I believed to be true and what I was called to do. And I guess I'm a slow learner. It took me 2 master's degrees to figure this out. But ultimately, I had a placement in hospice as an intern, serving as a chaplain. And it was the last place I ever thought I would want to be, because I still had some major issues around the death of my mom. And I was working with a spiritual director at the time, and he was so wise, and he said, "Jane, this is exactly what you need to do." And in 3 days of that internship, I recognized that I was home. I resonated with the journey. I resonated with the people that I had the privilege to listen to. And I felt that I didn't know their specific journey. I didn't pretend to know that. But I had an empathy and I had a compassion that was really heartfelt. And so I followed that calling. And ultimately, after serving as an intern for about a year, I was offered the directorship of education for a palliative care institute in Denver. I created curriculum for end-of-life issues specifically for about 6 years. And then I resigned and started my own business in 2011. And I've expanded the curriculum to include the continuum of care.
And tell us what you mean by the continuum of care.
Well, I think what we recognize when we work in end-of-life services such as hospice and palliative care, we are much better served if we address issues such as our mortality, the diagnosis, the prognosis, if we address those much further upstream instead of waiting for tipping points or moments of crises or ultimately the terminal diagnosis. And so if we are proactive in this journey of caregiving, we seek the information that we need and the resources that can support that journey, we are much better served.
Why do you think people are not more proactive about getting help and about planning for their own later chapters, final chapters?
Well, we live in an age-denying and death-averse society. Culturally, we just don't want to go there. We don't want to talk about it. And it is daunting. It's challenging to contemplate that at some point in time, I will cease to exist. I have no idea when that's going to be. But typically the tendency, again, depending on where you are in your respective journey, we are more or less inclined to start contemplating that endpoint on the horizon. And it's not just a personal challenge. Our families don't particularly want to go there. I talk to a lot of older adults that have children and grandchildren, and they're ready to have the conversation, to talk about their preferences about medical care or their final arrangements. And their children are throwing their hands up and running out of the kitchen saying, "No, we don't need to do that yet." And so it's hard to come to terms with that and to grips with it. But my invitation is this. I think when we contemplate the end of our story, we all have a different idea in mind. We all have a different setting, the people that we hope are there, the care that is going to be provided, everything that goes into that final narrative. And if our wishes are to equal our reality, I think it is mandatory that we articulate those wishes, share them with the people that will be responsible for our care. And that's still not 100% foolproof, but the odds are much better that ultimately our wishes will equal our reality.
That's profound and so important. I see this a lot in the estate planning context as I work with clients contemplating their mortality. When we stick our heads in the sand and pretend like it's not going to happen, we guarantee that it's not going to match what we would want it to look like. And mm-hmm. we miss out on the opportunity to have the richness here in this moment, in planning for it, in talking about it, in what that can bring in our conversations with our loved ones. And mm-hmm. we leave a mess for people.
Oh, absolutely. And I think another twist to this reality, as far as if we don't plan, there's a train wreck on the end of this discussion. But so many people are confronting the additional challenge of aging by themselves. And boomers are at risk of this because boomers typically have smaller families or opted not to have children, and we're living longer. And since women typically outlive men statistically, women at a greater percentage are contemplating who is going to care for me at the end of my life. And I'm a solo ager. That's the term you'll see in the literature. I'm the last one standing of my biological family. I'm divorced. I have no children. And I must be very intentional about making sure that I legally designate someone to be my medical durable power of attorney, that I have my finances in order, and even to the point of looking around at all of my stuff and saying, who is going to want this? Because I don't want to leave a mess for my friends. And so it comes down to some pretty simple logistics. It's get your ducks in a row, talk to people who are experts in the field of estate planning, and make sure you have everything together so that the ending is the best it can be for everyone concerned.
And it's interesting because I see a lot of solo agers or even couples who don't have children, don't have immediate family with whom they're close, who think it's not important for them to plan all of these things, even related to memorial service and, you know, burial versus cremation, all of those details. And it ultimately, there's something that happens when we have close family members and or children. There is somebody who's more likely to know more of my wishes. Let's mm-hmm. talk about your work with caregivers. What are some of the biggest challenges that you see for caregivers?
I think first and foremost is lack of preparation. Just like we were talking about previously, our society tends to be reactive instead of proactive when it comes to caring for our family members or friends. And oftentimes, I'll get a pushback from individuals to say, well, how in the world can I plan when I don't know what's going to happen? And agreed, we don't know exactly what healthcare issues we ourselves may confront or our family members. But at some point in time, we can rest assured that a caregiving journey is going to call us into that role of caregiver, and ultimately we will all require care. So we can start thinking ahead, who would I rely on? Who's going to be part of my caregiving team? And so we can have an outline of how this journey would proceed, and then we fill in the blanks as we get more specifics down the road. So I think preparation is one thing. Lack of information, which leads to an enhanced level of fear and anxiety, oftentimes paralyzes caregivers. They don't know where to turn, they don't know what questions to ask, and they're unfamiliar with the community resources that could be of great benefit, from everything from hands-on care to financial assistance and also long-term planning. And then I think also, caregiving is a multifaceted journey. It challenges us physically, emotionally, spiritually, financially, and psychosocially. And so we're juggling a lot of balls and a lot of concerns. And we're also dealing with a tremendous amount of change. And if you talk to most people and you ask them how they typically react to change, most people are not real fond of change. And so the nature of the journey of caregiving, if you're dealing with a progressive condition, it's a continuous process of change. One thing after another, and just when we think things are going well and we have a plateau of stability, something else happens. Many caregivers will experience something called change fatigue.
And what do you mean by change fatigue?
Well, let's say you get a diagnosis. That is a major change. It's a change in health. And change by definition means there's an ending, and when there's an ending, there's a sense of loss. Now, what most of us, I think it's important to recognize, most people will say they don't like change. Well, what we really don't like is the aftermath of change. what is oftentimes called a transitional period, where we're readjusting to life, we have a new sense of normal, and we're trying to come to terms with what just happened. Well, after the diagnosis, you have a situation you're coming to terms with, and let's say the situation exacerbates and you end up in the ER and something else happens, or maybe another disease process is diagnosed. And so just when you think you have your footing and your sea legs, something else seems to knock the props right out from under you. And so it's fear and anxiety and plus just this constant rebalancing every day. And it's roles, responsibilities, and a variety of other things, just trying to somehow establish a sense of normalcy and routine from one day to the next.
And normalcy and routine often get thrown out the window when somebody has a debilitating condition or disease like dementia. We don't get back to normal or routine or stable.
No, and that's the other realization that we come to with change. I heard this so often when I was sitting in on bereavement support groups when I worked in hospice. Almost without exception, when a person would come to a grief group, they would say, oh, I just want to wake up tomorrow and I want to go back to normal. I want my husband to be alive again. I want my day to be what I used to love. And the realization is you can't go back. The reality is that we can only look forward and anticipate establishing a new sense of normal. It doesn't mean it's going to be all bad, but it's going to be different. But one reason we oftentimes get stuck in the aftermath of change is we just keep looking over our shoulder and longing for what was, and that's no longer an option. So normalcy, we may give it short shrift sometimes, and we don't want to be normal, but we love our routines. We love the known. And we love feeling normal in our day-to-day existence.
And so what is a caregiver to do in a situation where there is no more normal and everything will be continuing to change from here forward? How do you help a caregiver navigate that change without just succumbing to change fatigue?
Well, I think first and foremost is to acknowledge the reality is you can't go back, and change is going to be part of the day-to-day experience. Secondly, be as proactive as you can. Understand how a disease process will unfold, and we acquire that information first from our medical professionals. If you have a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease, what is the expected progression of that particular disease? Are we looking at years? Are we looking at months? And that helps us to put a plan in place. Is this going to be a cognitive challenge, a physical challenge? And then we start to adapt to that new normal that we have. And I think another very important, ability and skill and maybe adaptation is to learn how to ask for and to receive help. And that is something as a culture most people find very difficult. It is so hard to be vulnerable enough and honest enough to ask family and friends, please help me. I can't do this all by myself, because we're raised to be independent. We love our autonomy. And sometimes we actually overplay being autonomous to the point that a strength becomes a weakness, because no one person can do all things, be all things all of the time without compromising their own health and well-being. So overcoming our resistance to assistance, that is one thing I talk about in almost every program I do for caregivers and care receivers. To open your arms, open your mind, open your heart to letting other people be part of that process.
Is that something that has come easily for you, I have to ask?
Oh, no. I am preaching to myself every time I do a program where I talk about resistance to assistance. Primary caregiving is the dominant model of caregiving in the United States, and I gravitated toward that when I was 15. I wanted to be in charge. I wanted to be in control, and so I ended up assuming the majority of the responsibility of care, and it took a toll. I paid the price for that. But it is still my natural tendency to do that. But the good news, at least I recognize it. And so I can make an informed choice. Should I invite other people to be part of this journey? And I'm learning gradually to do that. I was also encouraged when I was in hospice. I was talking to one of my mentors, another chaplain, and she reminded me one time that being a natural caregiver, that's a wonderful thing indeed. But she said to be fully human is to understand how to gracefully receive care from others. So I don't think I'm fully human yet, but at least I'm working on it.
Which is helpful for those of us who are learning from you to know that it's not just us who are struggling to practice receiving care. It's interesting. My father has had declining health and cognitive abilities over the last 20 years, not related to dementia, but due to some other issues. And I was just talking to my stepmom yesterday, and she has caregivers who are there full-time during the day, and she now has caregivers in the evening coming into the home. And I said, I hope that this will enable you to be present with Dad a little bit more and do a little less doing and a little more being. And she said, oh, no, it won't do that. She's at the point where she needs caregivers all of the day and all of the night, and she still can't receive the help and allow herself to be.
Well, you highlight, I think, a very important thing, that sometimes it's just serving as a mirror to remind family caregivers, is that when we're called to care, oftentimes our practical role of caregiver usurps our intimate role of wife or husband or daughter. And so we get very focused on what do I have to do today? And we miss those moments that are so sacred and so simple and so important of just being with the person that we're caring for and hopefully that we love. And so I'm always mindful to invite people. Yes, I know you're a caregiver, but don't lose the fact and don't lose that connection that you're also this other role. You're a mother, you're a spouse, you're a partner, whatever it might be. And we have to be intentional about that, because in caregiving there is so much to do. But we don't get to go back and recapture those moments that we missed. And those are the moments that sustain us during the toughest times of the journey.
That's something that when I accept that, when I see that in myself as a caregiver, and I've been a caregiver in a variety of different roles, that is where I find transformation for myself. That's where I find the beginnings of well-being, no matter what it is that I'm going through. When I can allow that to show me, whatever the situation is, to show me how I'm showing up and maybe what I'm missing, and learn a little bit of how to have more of the life that I really want to have, how to have more of the relationships I really want to have.
Mm-hmm. It's definitely a learning process, and it can actually transform the way you choose to live from that point forward.
What about, you talk about something we call compassion fatigue. Tell us a little bit about what that looks like. How can we recognize compassion fatigue in ourselves and in others?
Compassion fatigue is a topic that's been around for a number of decades. And initially, at least in the venues that I was introduced to this topic, it was professionals talking about compassion fatigue. But it certainly is relevant for family caregivers. Compassion fatigue is a kind of stress that we experience when we are overexposed or over-identify with the suffering of other people. And so for a family caregiver, it's the experience, if you're living with the person that you're caring for, it's that 24/7 witnessing of a person that's dealing with a serious chronic or perhaps a terminal illness. And as we witness that, we take on a bit of their suffering. And if we forget that it's not ours to hold, it's not our lived experience, that can build up and it starts to weigh heavy on our hearts and our minds, and it just doesn't go away. And ultimately, the biggest risk, if we don't recognize we have this kind of stress, we actually have a reduced capacity to care. And so we just end up going through the motions. We distance ourselves from the source of that suffering. And so the relationships become strained. We numb out. We just kind of flatline emotionally. And we just trudge through that journey of caregiving, missing so many things in the process.
I've seen that happen with people. And one of the things that I've noticed is that when someone is in this place of compassion fatigue, it's really hard for them to see that they are exhausted, overwhelmed, and have shut down. How can we recognize this in ourselves? How can we recognize and help others who've hit that point?
Well, I think self-awareness is certainly important, but oftentimes when we're in the journey of caregiving, we feel like we don't even have time to breathe, much less be self-aware. So it's good to have people in our lives that know us and can gently be that mirror to say, hey, Jane, you're not yourself. What's going on? You know, and not in a punitive or judgmental way, but to say, I'm concerned about you. You know, how do you feel? Do you realize that I'm recognizing patterns of behavior that usually mean you're stressed? And for some people, it may be isolation. It could be flatlining emotionally and not emoting at all, not communicating with family member and friends. It could be we start to have our own medical issues and we're going to the doctor more and more often for colds or flus or whatever. So we manifest stress in a variety of different ways, but usually we know our bodies well enough to recognize those alarm bells. But when we're in the caregiving role, we oftentimes ignore them until we have a crisis. This always leads to the discussion of self-care. And in my world, self-care is not optional for caregivers. And so I try to encourage people to religiously do some form of self-care every single day. And when I make that statement, I have caregivers look at me and furrow their brow, shaking their head like, seriously, you think I have time to focus on myself every single day?
Because there's nothing like being a caregiver to convince us that that's not even an option.
Well, so I give the invitation to implement a program of self-care 5 minutes a day. 5 minutes a day. And that can be life-changing for the experience of a caregiver. So I encourage people to identify what brings you joy, what soothes your soul, and what calms your spirit. And everybody's going to identify something unique. Some of us may gravitate toward music. Some may love to read for 5 minutes, just sit in silence. Whatever it is, what fills you up? And when you identify that 5-minute activity, then carve out a specific period of time every day and don't let anything interfere with it. And when you have 5 minutes under your belt and you faithfully do it every day, increase that to 10 minutes. Now, that may take a year to increase to 10 minutes, and that's fine. But just having that intentionality to say, I'm worth 5 minutes right here and right now. I'm just going to focus on me. That makes a big shift in your psyche and in your soul. And sometimes that's just that little bit that we need to kind of get us over the hump and to realize, okay, I can do this.
That was so profound right there. Can you say one more time, what brings you joy, what soothes your soul,
and what fills you up?
What fills you up?
Mm-hmm.
5 minutes.
I learned that from a caregiver in the trenches at a conference years ago, and she was juggling 3 family members who were critically ill plus a job, and I was like, if you can find 5 minutes, I can find 5 minutes.
You have taken a lot of your wisdom and shared it with the world in a variety of different contexts. One of the places that you've done that is in a book. And it's interesting, I've seen a lot of how-to books for dummies, brain surgery for dummies, everything for dummies. You wrote a different kind of book for caregivers called Caregiving for the Genius. So, of course, my question is, do I have to be a genius to read your book?
No, you do not. And the title was actually determined by my publisher. He has an entire series of books called For the Genius. And he's got a quirky sense of humor, but he loves to say that he gives his reading audience much more credit than some other publishers. And he also highlights the definition of genius, which, according to Thomas Edison, genius is 90% perspiration and 10% inspiration. So, all are welcome to read my book and hopefully to tease out a nugget that might prove to be beneficial to themselves or to their family. And I typically, when I write in a conversational tone. I imagine someone sitting across my breakfast table, sipping a cup of coffee or hot tea, and I start to write as if I'm having a conversation with them. So I tell a lot of stories. Some stories come from my own lived experience as a caregiver, and some of the stories are composite from a myriad of people that I've met over the course of my 62 years, stories that have informed and influenced and shaped the person that I am and the person that I hope to be, and also certainly have informed me about the journey of offering care as well as receiving care.
I know that that book has been helpful to so many. Where can people find that book?
Caregiving for the Genius is available on Amazon.com, and it's a paperback, and it's also available in the Kindle or ebook format.
Wonderful. One of the principles that I know you and I both believe is that even the hardest things in life bring us gifts. Tell me about a gift that you've received through caregiving or through any challenge in your life.
I think one of the greatest gifts I've received from the work I've done since I started in hospice and then started my business, one of the greatest gifts I've received is listening to people and companioning people who are confronted by the reality of their mortality. They have a terminal diagnosis. Listening to them, watching them, and encouraging them to be present to their experience. They really have taught me how to live, how I want to live. And many of my friends, when I first told them I was going to work in hospice, their reaction was less than enthusiastic. They were concerned that it would be depressing, and how can you be around death every day and talk about death? And the experience is so much different than the general public's perception of hospice. Yes, you're dealing with mortality and you're dealing with a terminal diagnosis, but the focus is on life. How do we choose to live until the very last moment? So, having served as a professional caregiver and then all of my experience companioning my family members and some very dear friends, I'm much more intentional about how I choose to live every moment of the day. I'm much more attentive, I'm much more aware, and I'm certainly much more grateful. I noted that I'm the last one standing from my family of origin. I have the gift to be alive today. And so I also have a responsibility to live into that gift and hopefully contribute back in a very meaningful way.
I can't imagine a gift greater than learning how to live, especially before we are terminally ill or close to death.
Well, I am blessed indeed because I get reminders every day from the people that I encounter in classes, on the street, in stores. I hear just phenomenal stories of courage and commitment and faith and love and family, and all of those are inspiring, and they certainly are my greatest mentors.
Is there anything else that you wanted to share or any parting words of wisdom that you have for us?
I don't know that I've acquired wisdom on my own. I certainly have benefited from the wisdom of others. But I think in closing, I would say that caregiving is probably one of the hardest things that we will ever be called to do. And it's also one of the most sacred. And 2 or 3 years ago, actually 3 years now, this March, I was called to help care for my brother. He was diagnosed with terminal cancer as well and had a very short period of time once we had the accurate diagnosis. And I was struggling with balancing my own business and my own life in Denver and traveling back to Texas and all the logistics that bubble up in those moments. And thank goodness I listened to my heart and I traveled to Texas and I shared an extraordinarily difficult 4 or 5 days at the end of his life. And those 4 or 5 days have served to change how I choose to live. And as always, my big brother taught me some very important lessons at the end of his life. So I just want to encourage all of us that we are braver and bolder than we ever imagined. And yes, this can be a very difficult journey, particularly at the end of life. But it's a moment, it's a once-in-a-lifetime moment, and hopefully a moment that you will not miss because it can serve to enhance and inform how you choose to live from this day forward and how you can choose to be a blessing to all those around you.
I feel like this has been sacred ground, just talking with you about these things. Really, you've had an impact on me just through our conversation here. How can people find you if they want more?
Well, they can check out my website. It's cardinallife.com, and it's just one L, CardinalIfe.com. They can always drop me an email at cardinallife@msn.com, and that's probably the best way to contact me because I'm usually out and about or presenting a class and phone calls just serve to frustrate. But I'm happy to respond to emails and I typically do so in less than 24 hours.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Jane, for your time and your wisdom.
Well, it's been my delight.
Get answers to your practical challenges and support in overcoming them. Check out our community online at athrivinglife.org. You can also access all of our podcasts on our website.